Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the From the Vaults Rugby Podcast. My name is Phil McGowan and this World Rugby Museum podcast will explore some of the greatest players and moments in rugby's long history, featuring first-hand witnesses, commentary and interviews with the people who shaped our sport. In this podcast, we will be talking to former England and Fiji coach Ben Ryan about his life in rugby, from Wimbledon College to Cambridge Blue to leading Fiji to a historic first gold medal at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
So we're going to talk about the Olympics, that's the main focus, but we'll go right back and talk about your early sort of experiences of rugby. Do you want to tell us how you first got involved?
Under sevens at Richmond. Back then, the mini rugby was just starting. So the two teams, London Scottish and Richmond, that share the ground combined. So it was a Richmond shirt with a Scottish badge. Captain Mack was my first coach at under sevens. First training session was full on tackling, which I loved. My mum took me to that. And then I stayed all the way through Richmond till I went to uni. So yeah, it was an amazing first time that I played rugby. I loved it. I was only a little ginger kid, but I loved the contact and all of that stuff.
Yeah, any rugby players in your background and your family?
Yeah, my dad was an international athlete in javelin, but he represented Cheshire and Broughton Park and Sale and the RAF and stuff like that, or rugby as well. He's an open side flanker, but back then he had much worse eyesight than me. He actually wore his glasses when he was playing, so I'm not sure he would have been very good over the ball these days, but yeah, he loved it. And he set up, actually, he's a former first captain of the Obedians, which is a club up in Manchester. So him and his mate formed that club. There's a bit of a history in rugby, but only just that generation.
Yeah, and you developed as a scrum half.
Yeah, I kind of played all over when I was a kid. And I moved all over the shop, but I ended up as a scrum half mainly at Cambridge and Loughborough and then in the old First Division, which was the Premiership. So I played that very first year the game went pro in the mid-90s at West Hartlepool. And that was a fun time as well. And that was when we didn't really know what was going on. You know, we got paid to play, but we had all this time on our hands and spent a lot of it in saunas and drinking cups of tea back then, I think.
And you mentioned it already, but you got two Blues at Cambridge.
Yeah, so I played in the last 2 years when the game was still amateur. So at that point, the team was it was a really strong team. We beat the test side, Samoa. We beat Queensland when they came over on tour. We ran South Africa A close and had that sort of level of games and would play Premiership sides and knock them over. And, you know, my captain was a four-time All Black trialist, who's now the current lawyer for the All Blacks. Number eight played for the All Blacks after leaving Cambridge. The hooker played for Australia. Half our back line played international rugby, and I think everyone in that team went on to play minimum at least Premiership. And then professionalism came in, and with that, you know, that kind of vehicle where people went to Oxbridge to try and get a job and play high quality rugby kind of disappeared a little bit, and the academies and professional game took over.
And you got a run out at Twickenham at that time as well?
Yeah, we actually, I can't remember if it was the first or the second Blue, but it was a world record crowd for a club match, and it was the first match under floodlights at Twickenham as well. So 79,000 people, and actually in one of those games, right at the end, a spectator dressed as a Viking ran on the field and smashed me as I was just about to box kick the ball, and his spike got me right in the thigh. So I had a bit of a dead leg from his horn, but yeah, so I've got some happy memories of kind of those amateur days.
Okay, so and you grew up around rugby, so earliest memories of Fijian rugby, obviously it must have always been there.
It's a weird one. My earliest memory, and I couldn't tell you the time, although I think Kevin Baring, who used to work with me at the RFU, was kind of my mentor, was there maybe playing. It was, I think, London Welsh versus Fiji at Old Deer Park down the road. And they were on tour and playing. London Welsh, who were very strong back then. And I remember my dad taking me down there, and I just got really vivid memories. I can remember the black and white thick striped shirts and the socks. And that's about it. But that's my first memory of Fiji, I guess.
I remember watching the Middlesex Sevens on TV, and Serevi stood out, and the commentators just loved him.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was lucky enough to play against Fiji Sevens team twice, the team that won the World Sevens, the World Cup. And Serevi was captain. I was playing opposite him at scrum half. So, and Vuni Bakker and people like that were playing in that team. I was very lucky I got to play against him. And obviously, subsequently, and I wasn't to know 20 years later that I'd end up, you know, him becoming a good friend and an ally, because he is still, you know, probably the best player ever to play the game of sevens.
What was it like playing against Fiji as England coach? How challenging?
Yeah, to absolutely get everything right and hope that they were perhaps having a bit of an off day. One thing that I knew they didn't do very much of when I was England coach, analysis. So they wouldn't have watched us play. And so that meant if we decided to have a different kickoff strategy or a different line out or just a slightly different change of plan of penalty moves, you'd often catch them cold, catch them off guard. And Isoa Ndamu, who was in the British Army and was playing for England, he'd always say before every game, just keep the ball, keep the ball. And we had to keep the ball for, you know, 80-85% of the time against Fiji to make sure that their broken field, their turnover game, we couldn't defend that for long periods. So we had over the 7 years I was in charge, I had a winning record against Fiji. We should never really have had that. And I think that was just because we caught them cold and off guard on a few occasions.
So you'd analysed their weaknesses before you came coach?
It was more like, so when I went to coach Fiji, I knew that what they weren't doing. I knew what they could do. And so as a coach, you obviously want to build on those things, on their strengths. But then there were some very simple foundations and principles that I needed to change.
You had a job at UK Sport waiting for you, and you made a bit of a left field turn. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, it's a mate told me on Twitter that Fiji are looking for a sevens coach. I had accepted a job with UK Sport, back of house, kind of more logistics and strategy with all their sports teams towards, you know, Olympic Games and 4 year cycles. But I didn't really feel it was ready to leave coaching. And so I got this friend that said that. I applied to Fiji. I missed the deadline, but they knew who it was. So he said, let's have a meeting on Skype. I was living in Teddington at the time, so 2 o'clock in Suva was 2 a.m. in England. I put a tie on, first time since I left school probably. Sat down at the breakfast table, had the laptop out, a couple of espressos, waited at 2 o'clock, bang, nothing. 2:30, nothing. Got to about 4 o'clock and eventually Skype rings. Now, if you've been to Fiji, you'd probably understand about Fiji time, you know, no hurry, no worry. So they took their time to get to me. And when my face went up onto the screen, it also went up onto the back of the CEO's office in 35 Gordon Street in Suva. And everybody was peering into the camera, asking me questions like, you know, have I met the Queen? Do I know Johnny Wilkinson? You know, important like interview questions. And I said, no, look, I met Johnny, and no, I've never met, I don't know the Queen. And I stayed awake, which I thought was great. And in the morning, I thought I'd find out a little bit more about Fiji, got on the Fiji Times on the website, and the CEO who had interviewed me had been sacked immediately after an interview. So I thought, that's that. And then a few weeks later, actually around the corner from this museum, we were in Richmond having dinner, and my phone rings, and it was a Fiji number. And I said, hi, this is Berlin Kafoa. I'm the acting chief executive of Fiji Rugby Union. We've got a press conference in 20 minutes. I said, cool, what's it about? Berlin said, it's to appoint you as a new head coach. So I said, okay, do I have any say in this? He said, yeah, call me back in 20 minutes. So if I'd had a day, I'd have said no. You'd have been too pragmatic and I'd worried about too many things. But I didn't, and I knew I needed to do something different. I needed to kind of get back to how I was as a coach at the start. And I took that risk. I didn't know that I wasn't going to get paid for 6 months. I didn't know that how long my contract was. I didn't know that none of the boys were contracted, that the union had gone bankrupt, that they were being investigated by World Rugby, all these various things. But I just said yes, all right. And yeah, I'd have not changed that decision for the world. Probably the best decision I've ever made.
Right, it wasn't the sensible choice, was it? No. You were aware that there was a gamble going on. Was it something to do with having seen Fiji and understanding that they had potential?
Oh, I think if you're a sevens coach and you know you're playing at Fiji and you have a good understanding that they're probably as talented or the most talented rugby players on the planet, but you can also see that they play with a joy that if you're a coach that wants to play that way with a thin playbook, not a thick one, and it's player led and it's all about attacking flair and playing in the moment and keeping the ball alive, then the opportunity ever comes around where you might actually be able to start coaching them, it's just very alluring. And so I can see now going back why, I took that risk. I knew I needed to personally, but my heart was kind of singing, even if my stomach was doing somersaults. So as a coach, you want to, it's like a football coach being asked to coach Brazil, or, why would you turn it down?
And did you think you could turn them into the best sevens team in the world then, or...?
Do you know that, like, the first week I got over there, the team was picked by 9 selectors. I had never met any of the selectors. I didn't know any of the players from the previous year. They'd all gone overseas. They'd had dropped the one player that I knew, Osea Kalinasau, that I ended up making captain. We had a fitness test in week one, and I won the fitness test. First tournament 5 days later, my old team, England, gave us a pretty good hiding in the quarterfinals of the Gold Coast. And then I got on the plane where the chief executive said that I'm not going to get paid for 5 months and I have to do it as a volunteer. I still thought, with those brief moments with the team, having a look at what was available on the island, that we would, at that point, I thought 3 years' time we could win an Olympic gold medal, yeah.
So the Olympics was on the horizon right then?
Day one.
Right. Okay, and what was it like arriving at Fiji? Had you been there before?
No, I'd never been there.
Was it the first time?
I'd played against Fiji, coached against Fiji and coached Fijian players. But I'd never been there before. So I arrived, a long old flight to Fiji, 3 flights we took, I think. And I just thought I'd be able to just get my head down, wake up in the morning and have meetings. But I was met by live television and welcome home Ben signs and hundreds of people at the airport. And so it was a whirlwind start, really, where you're just trying to listen, to understand, not to answer, and get as much information to just see what you'd gone into. And that first night after, I'd met half the government cabinet and the Fijian Rugby Union and all the people and live on TV, and I got back to the hotel that evening. I sat on the bed and I was like, wow, I'm just so far out of my comfort zone. This is the worst decision I've ever made. But you wake up in the morning and you see the Pacific Ocean and the Pacific Sea, sunshine, sorry, and meet the people. And then the kind of journey began, I suppose.
Mm. You won the Dubai Sevens in your first season?
Yep. So that first tournament in Gold Coast, where I didn't really have any control, had 3 training sessions with them, didn't pick the team. We got knocked out in the quarters. I then went home, packed my bags, moved house to live in Fiji, and had about 7 weeks to get the team ready for Dubai. And we just went to basics. I didn't play around too much with their attack. We just did some offloading stuff. Defensively, I thought, I just want to keep 7 players on the field. So no high tackles, no yellow cards. That was our defensive strategy. And then I applied Pareto's law, 80% of your success on 20% of the things you do. And I didn't have a budget, so I had to do something that didn't impact on costing us anything. So I just ran them hard for 6-7 weeks and tried to sort out their diet. But it was running them hard up in sand dunes at Singa Toka, the World Heritage Site. That my dad used to talk about, Herb Elliott, a famous Australian middle distance runner, how he had based a lot of his running on that. And we did that and we got them really, really fit in a short period of time. And genetically, the Fijian boys can get fit really fast. And we did that. And then we went to Dubai and we beat New Zealand in the semi-finals. And New Zealand, that was one of the big allures for me. New Zealand, Fiji, I'd watched them play over the years and they were just mammoth games. They just threw everything at it. It looked like physically they all went up a level. And we got to play them in that semi-final. And we inflicted the heaviest defeat New Zealand have had at any level at international sevens or 15s. It's 44-0. We actually missed most of our conversions as well. We hadn't sorted out our kicking at that point. But that, and then went on and beat South Africa pretty well in the final as well, and won Dubai for the first time ever. That gave me breathing time as a coach with Fiji, because they could see that I had success. I kept saying to everybody, like, with the sunshine, we're going to have lots of showers, because it was built on paper at that point. But it did allow me to have time as a Fijian coach, and I quickly found out how passionate the Fijians were. And, you know, if you don't win tournaments, the old coach said, your house is going to get stoned. So that didn't happen to me. And it just gave me that ability to be able to then put some other things in place that built the program over those first 6-9 months to give us a chance.
And did the players buy into your strategies at once, or was it a slow process?
Very slow, because they kind of just nodded their heads and agreed to anything I said. You know, although most of them could speak English, not all of them were comfortable and confident to do that. So I had a real ally in the captain who had been dropped. We then had an injury in that first tournament that allowed me to pick him. He was the only player I picked in that very first tournament we lost in the Gold Coast. And we instantly aligned. We both felt the same about the game. We both had kind of points to prove career-wise for both of us. And he became like a cultural architect, and he was that conduit between the players at the start. And from him then, everything else started to filter down to the players until we had buy-in, you know, and I obviously, my Fijian got better. They got more confident speaking to me, and the whole thing started to click.
And you got that victory against New Zealand. When did you start to perform like that consistently?
Good question, really. In the first season, we won two tournaments. We only really lost a handful of games, but we didn't have any contracts. And so players, if they did well, were then disappearing off pretty quickly. So that season, it was probably here in the last tournament, we lost to New Zealand last play in the semi-final, and we'd lost them the week before in the last play in Glasgow. And I could see that we were just a fraction away from turning those around and having long runs. And then the following year, following tournament, I think we went on a big, long, unbeaten run against New Zealand that ran in 7 or 8 games in a row, and then we won back-to-back world titles the following 2 years. So I'd say it took about 6 months to click. And, mm-hmm. and I guess when that time ended, so did the resource drought. We got a bit of cash. I got paid, and we started to see the results.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And then you won the title that second year and again the third year. So you're then on top of the pile with the Olympics ahead.
Yeah.
How do you maintain that consistency going forward?
We had an overall strategy. Like, we knew August 11th, 2016 was the Olympic final. And so I planned for 3 years on that basis, knowing that we hadn't qualified. We had day one, it was a very different story to the final day. And then, so we had these very small, different, well, not small, but we had these challenges that we wanted to do on the way to the journey. And once we had got qualified for the Olympics, we then wanted to win the series. And then that following year, where we'd already qualified, I wanted to bring in some players that to try them, but we also wanted to retain our title. I didn't want to go into the Olympics, even if we were number one seed, as not the current World Series champions. So they were sub-goals underneath it all. And then once you are number one, you want to stay there. And I know a lot of people say that, you know, that, you know, it's harder to stay at the top. But actually, like, there's also that fear. Like, you don't want to give up that number one slot. And so we kept our standards high. Very simple framework around all the players. You create a psychologically safe environment where everyone feels like they can say their bit, where they have belief and purpose. Straight lines of leadership as well. I think, you know, although they knew I was their boss, they knew they could talk to me and that they could be open with things. So it worked. Our program worked. And when we got to the Olympics, you know, it was a team that was as well prepared as I've ever had at any level.
And Fiji have never won an Olympic medal of any type up to that point. So what was the expectation like amongst Fijians before the Olympics?
It was all about gold medals. It was in all the papers for months, really. And we didn't really shy away from that either. You know, we were number one seeds. We were back-to-back world champions. We'd beaten everybody consistently over 24 months and clear favourites for the Olympics. But it was the first time we'd all gone into the Olympic Games, and having been as a visitor to London, and hearing stories from my dad from 48 and 52 Olympics when he was a reserve and he was living in the village in London and Helsinki, I had an idea about it, but I knew how easily Olympic Games can throw individuals and teams. People get it wrong at Olympic Games, and I saw that both in our sport and in other sports. So there was obviously, there was that unknown, I suppose, that we were trying to cut down as many things that we could control, make sure that were many, as much that we could, that was in our control, we did. So we were the last team going into the village, took their phones and mobiles. Nobody had any outside communication. We did everything together. We'd already hit their diets really hard and taken sugar out for a few months, and just kept distractions to a minimum. Because the Olympic Village, although it's, you know, it's got your Federers and your basketball dream teams and your Usain Bolts, it's also got a lot of Olympic tourists that are going to lose their first round, their first matches, and then there's a lot of fun to be had in the village if you're not aligned and focused. So I think we got all of that right as well, and that added to, you know, what we did on the field.
So on to that, Brazil, Argentina and USA in the groups.
Yeah.
And not the best performances of the tournament.
No, and we actually made a conscious decision because it was a bit of a pain really trying to get to all the different training venues and stuff like that. The team actually had never gone to the ground before the first game against Brazil. So that was all new to them. You know, now, you know, back when I was with England, you know, you'd have your recces and your pre-recces and all that sort of stuff. But we kind of underplayed it all. We said, look, a pitch is a pitch. So we'll just get on with it. They're used to having very bare minimum in Fiji. So we got there and we knew that Brazilian team, although they're not, you know, top 15 team in the world, they just would have been running purely on adrenaline and passion. And over 14 minutes, you can keep that going for quite a long time. They were flying around at 100 miles an hour. I think they might even have scored the first try. But at no point did I know that we were going to be in any trouble, and we kind of just slowly got ourselves probably only just out of first gear really in that first game. But by then I understood the psyche of the Fijian boys, and I knew how they would do enough. They weren't going to blow their gasket on game one. They weren't going to, you know, get there. Often I'd been with England teams that just got overly aroused, and their fastest sprint times were when they ran out of the tunnel, and the Fijian boys weren't like that. They just took things in their stride, and we just built. And we knew that second game against Argentina was going to be a tough one. Again, another local South American team that I thought were good enough to win a medal, and I thought they were really unlucky not to. And they're a hard team to play, contest for every breakdown. And so to go 2-2 in the first day and not get any injuries, that was job done for us, really. And then the following day, it was USA. We'd already qualified for the quarterfinals, and then we were in a situation where if we beat USA, we knock them out, but we actually, because of New Zealand's first round loss to Japan, we give New Zealand a ticket to get into the knockouts. If USA had beaten us, we'd have still qualified for the quarterfinals, I think, as number one seed, but New Zealand would have been knocked out, our chief rivals. But we took the game, as we should do, knocked over USA, and that meant that we then would play later in the day in New Zealand and beat them. And it's quite narrow, but again, I never really felt like we were in trouble. We had the majority of the ball. They had scarce chances. They took a couple of opportunities, but then really that after day two, we were into the semi-finals, and we had one injury that miraculously got cured overnight. And then we lost one other player to injury that got replaced by Masavesi Dakawanga, who's partially blind in one eye, and he came into the squad. So by day three, we were still in really good shape.
And whilst all of this going on, there's the GB team that had been thrown together at very short notice.
Yeah.
And is outperforming expectations.
Yeah.
When did you start to think about a potential meet with them in the final?
I thought we'd play South Africa in the final. They were the team that gave us the most problems, and in fact we had spent quite a lot of time in training devising a strategy, especially for South Africa's kicking game and set piece game, and we're ready to kind of, I suppose, ambush them a little bit with a slightly different way of playing against them, and I was really comfortable with that and excited actually to try to see if that was going to work. And yeah, you're right, Great Britain came up the behind everybody really. You know, their game against Argentina went into extra time, and Argentina missed a very simple kick at goal to win the game. And then in the semi-finals, they played South Africa, and their star player, Sanatla, the game before, had just kicked the ball out to finish the game and win it. And he landed badly on his ankle, and he got ruled out of that semi-final. And he was, when you look back at that semi-final, you know, you can see how much they missed him. But Great Britain joining that overall big machine of Team GB, I think they didn't want to go back to GB House in the village not having got a medal under their belts. And so, you know, when it ended up being Fiji and Great Britain, I was really confident that we were going to do a job in the final against Great Britain. But five of that starting team, I'd given debuts for England Sevens team. I'd known some of them since they were 16 or 17. And I was really pleased that they were going to get an Olympic medal. It wasn't going to be the colour perhaps they wanted, but I think they would have taken that at the beginning of the tournament.
And did it make it more complicated for you mentally?
No, it didn't. I really didn't mind about who it was on the other side of the field. We were really at that perfect point, I guess, where you've got a team that are over competent, so they know exactly what their roles and responsibilities are, and they've got alignment. Their core skills are great. They're as fit as they've ever been. They've got a great leader, and they're also a leaderful team. They had all of that stuff going on. But often when you get that, occasionally overconfidence can slip in. But with the team and the humility and the captain and the Fijians around me as well, they didn't have that. So, you know, going into that final, they looked relaxed as I've ever seen them.
And did you need to do anything to bring that about, or was that just all inbuilt within the...
No, first time we won the world title here, I had to do a few things in the change room before the game because they were off scale, over aroused. And we were playing a quarter final here to beat South Africa. Winner took it all, whoever won their quarter final. So that was our final. No one cared what happened after that game. And they were crying before the game. And I'd seen a Fijian team when I was with England get over aroused in the Hong Kong final and almost blow it against Wales. So at that point, I could, you know, we did something this time around. Before the final, I had got this big speech ready to tell everyone, you know, it's my moment, right? I've seen Any Given Sunday and Friday Night Lights. But I went in the change rooms. They were bouncing around. They were happy. They were talking to each other, having these little conversations. Their chins were up. They were smiling. I thought, if I say anything, it's only for me. It's not going to make them any better. So I just said, have fun. And I walked out. And that was that, really.
And this is on the eve of the biggest achievement in the country sporting history. How did they, why were they so calm, do you think?
They were just so, I think they there was certainly an element of them that felt there was fate involved. They felt that this was their destiny. They wanted to bring home a gold. They knew how hard we'd worked. And, you know, I'd never worked a team as hard as I did in those 12 weeks I think we had before the Olympic Games. And we had, you know, back-to-back tournaments at home against each other, against the best players in the world. You know, Josh Tuasova was up against Sathi Ratha, who was, you know, the top try scorer that year. And Leonie Nakarawa, one of the biggest, best world player of the year, against Bill Matta, who's now like a top Pro 12 player of the season. And they were just going head to head. So they just felt super confident about their abilities, and they had had the success coming into the tournament to back it up. They'd been to every three-day tournament in the last 2 years and won. And so they knew that underneath that competency, they had that experience that they, you know, if they play well, they deliver.
And the game itself, in the end, wasn't much of a contest. It was more of a demolition. So yeah. What was it like watching from the sideline?
It kind of was like... the two tunnels have been really interesting for anybody to just see the Great Britain on one side, stiff, nervous, as you would be for an Olympic final. And then the Fijian boys, like the bell's about to go for lunch and they're going to go and run on the field and have fun with their mates. And I walk around the back. I'm not a coach that says good luck to the opposite number. I don't really mean it. I don't really want them to have a lucky bounce of the ball or a referee's decision that goes their way. So I might shake their hand, but I'll generally try to avoid them and do it afterwards and congratulate them if they've beaten us. And then as soon as they ran on the field, I could just see that the boys looked super relaxed and they were actually almost running in unison. And after 30 seconds, Osea Klinasau, our captain, scored the first try in the left-hand corner, just riding a Tom Mitchell tackle. And then we scored four more and five tries by half-time, 29-0. And then that allowed us to empty the bench and give everybody a really good run and have that last, that second half really an opportunity to kind of just, soak it all in. You don't normally get that in sevens. 90% of the games are won or lost in that last 30 seconds and we had won by half time. So you can think about all the people that helped you get there and the journey that you'd been on and really take it all in.
And is that what the players were doing after the game finished?
After the game finished, yeah, they all said a simple prayer and then we went on the field, shook everyone's hands, and then I whispered in everyone's ears, you're an Olympic gold medalist now. And that was probably the coolest thing I got to do in all my time in Fiji, to see their reaction, their smiling. We'd had a long journey together and it was, and there were lots of highs and lows. We'd had a devastating cyclone. We'd had illness and injury in the team. We'd had players' wives dying and all of that stuff kind of got us all tight as a team. So this was our final point. Everybody knew it. After that final, we were all going to disappear to various parts of the world, either the players with contracts and I had told them that I was leaving. So it was all known that this was our final point. And then they did the Fijian traditional thing that if you get given a gift, you bow down to receive it and say thank you. And you do the thombo with two cupped hands and Princess Anne knew exactly. She wasn't told about it beforehand, but she'd been to the islands and knew the cultural exchange there. So she replied in the traditional Pacific way, and I think that's the only time that anybody's received a medal has done that. And I didn't know that was happening either. But the boys would often surprise me with the things they'd do. You'd be at airports and seeing them taking the bags off other people, the carousel for other people. We had a flight once where two people were having suspected heart attacks and the boys just stood up and started delivering the chicken or fish to everybody as the staff were dealing with what was going on. And they would do that all the time. Vela Mani, which is the strap line that we used throughout our 3 years, means to work together, to love each other. And they really lived that every day.
And when you go back to Fiji, the reaction?
Well, it's hard, even if I have dark glasses and a cap on, there aren't too many gingers on the island, so I can't really go there without getting spotted. They were lovely to me, the people. I'm also a chief now in Fiji, the only non-Fijian chief, so Ratu Peni Rayani Latinara from Sarua, from the Latinara clan. So that was an amazing experience to be given that, and then the whole process of becoming a chief and what you have to do for that. And they gave me land and put me on the banknotes and bank coins. So I'm really grateful for everything that happened with them. And, you know, it still feels in many ways like home.
That gives the flavour of it. But what did it mean to people in Fiji to win a gold medal in the Olympics?
Fijians are very proud of the rugby team, and the rugby team comes from the people. You know, it's a classless society by and large, really. So these boys, you know, a lot of them had jobs, worked in, come from the villages. None of them were superstars. And it's a tiny dot in the middle of the Pacific, and it's not known for too many things. But for that brief moment, they were the best at what they did, and they could quite rightly say that. And so all the people were really proud of being Fijian. It united everybody. It's still it's quite a multi-ethnic makeup of the country. And everybody was together and having fun and united about things. And there was a real feel-good that lasted a pretty long time, actually. They, you know, Fijians like to have a party, and they made it a long one. We had, I think, 3 days bank holidays back-to-back when we flew back. And it was a pretty crazy but beautiful time.
And for you personally, winning a gold medal probably wasn't something you anticipated early on.
No, I think, I don't know. I mean, you always have ambitions as a coach. You know, when I was a kid, you know, 8 or 9, you know, and I'm watching Seb Coe run against Steve Ouellette live on TV, and Steve Cram and those guys, you had those dreams as a kid of going to the Olympics. And so I didn't go there that way as an athlete, or ended up going there as a coach. From day one in Fiji, I thought we could win an Olympic gold medal. It's very different from the actual reality of slipping it around someone's neck or actually achieving that goal. I can't say I felt elation after the end. You kind of felt like that was meant to happen, and that is what happened. And I slept ridiculously soundly that night. And then it kind of leaves a bit of a hole. What next? But I kind of put that to one side and enjoyed the celebrations and spent time with, you know, the team and the management that have all become, you know, really good friends.
Last one. So like you, I watched Steve Ouellette and Steve Cram in the Olympics and just, you know, dreamed of being in any sport. I would watch anything at the Olympics. But what does the Olympics now mean to rugby sevens in particular, do you think?
It's a massive game changer, the Olympics, to rugby sevens. You know, we've gone on a roller coaster as a sport. You know, it got close to kind of disappearing a little bit. When, you know, we were struggling to attract the quality of players as the game went professional, as clubs kept players and wouldn't release them to sevens. And then Olympics came along, and World Rugby did brilliantly to get men and women's game involved. And now, you know, the success of Rio, seeing a team that doesn't generally win Olympic medals, win a gold medal, ticked all the IOC boxes, won the IOC team performance of the games. And was a highlight for a lot of people. And it was at the end of that week one, you know, on the Saturday night. And it kind of just put rugby on a pedestal for a while. And so that's meant that the sevens game now is attracting more sponsors, more people who are aware of it, more countries are getting better. You're seeing the ascent of the USA. We've already got teams like Kenya and Samoa and Canada that are doing well. And now we're seeing more and more teams at the top table that can win a tournament on any given day. You know, that doesn't happen in 15s, but in 7s you can truly say that's going to grow, and that for participation and for people understanding the game, that's only a good thing.
Thanks for listening to From the Vaults. If you're not already, please follow us on @WRugbyMuseum at Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Sign up to our blog, also called From the Vaults, on WordPress. And more importantly, come down and visit the World Rugby Museum here at Twickenham Stadium. Please subscribe to From the Vaults for regular content like this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.